Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Henri Barkey, Professor of International Relations at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania and a Senior Fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller. And his latest article at The National is Limited Strikes, Limited Goals, and No Strategy on Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barkey.
Thank you.
And I must say, having the UN rep, Nikki Haley, say that we're locked and loaded if Assad tries to use chemical weapons again really rang hollow, in the sense that we're basically saying it's okay to use barrel bombs, starvation, you name it, kill your own people in droves, but just don't use chemical weapons. It seems to sort of display the complete bankruptcy of our policy. But hasn't that been the case all along, that the Russians and the Iranians have known what they want, and so has Assad, but the West, and in particular the U.S., have never known what they wanted out of the Syria situation? They've known what they don't want, but not what they want. And it's always been a mess, hasn't it?
Yes. But that said, look, it was very clear from the beginning that the United States was not going to get involved in a land war against the regime, especially after what happened in Iraq. I mean, President Obama was very clear about this. He tried to avoid any which way he could to get involved in Syria, including not sending bombers when Assad used weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, back in 2013. So I think at this stage to say that the United States and the allies are allowing Assad and his henchmen and his allies to kill as many people as they want without chemical weapons, it's true, but it's also unfair. We need to ask ourselves the question, do we want the United States to go into a land war? Because that's the only way that a regime change can take place. And what was doable maybe 5 years ago or 6 years ago is no longer doable now. It's because you have large numbers of Russians and Iranian troops there. So we need to be, in that sense, a little bit realistic about what is possible and what is not possible.
So what's your sense then of whether, I mean, when you talk about, you know, not being ready for a ground war, just recently, the 2,000 special forces that seem to be in a very key location, they occupy Assad's oil fields, which he obviously wants. They seem to be astride a potential land route between Tehran and Damascus. And, of course, Trump was about to basically pull them out recently. But they were attacked by the Syrian Fifth Corps, including a group of Russian mercenaries. And the air power that the U.S. has really was pretty devastating. So obviously it's too late to do anything, but it does seem that there is still American power there, and Trump is about to give up a chip in return for nothing. It seems like maybe he's been re-educated on that. What can the U.S. use this leverage to gain?
Look, the 2,000 American troops are in northeastern Syria, and they're allied with Syrian Kurds there. So they're not there alone. Yes, you're making reference to an event a few months ago when American troops and their allies came under fire from Syrians and mercenaries and Russian mercenaries, and the United States responded very strongly. But that was a one-off thing. To change the regime in Damascus, you need to occupy Damascus. This is different than having a military action in northeastern Syria, where there is no really serious regime presence, and you're there with the Syrian Kurds who are essentially of the region. So that's when, if you were to go into Damascus, you have a civilian population. Look, I'm not saying we should give up on the idea that Assad should go. I mean, it sounds to me as if everybody has come to the realization that he is going to be there for a while. There's not much we can do. We might as well live with it. I mean, that's a certainly realistic analysis, but I will submit to you that if the United States, together with its Gulf allies, with the Europeans, were to come up, maybe could come up. I'm not saying it's possible, but we need to rethink this whole strategy towards Assad and Syria. Maybe there is an alternative that is in between overthrow and Assad staying in power. Maybe there's a way we can cut a deal with the Iranians, with the Russians, once we have the Gulf allies and other countries, maybe the Indians, the Pakistanis, you know, other countries together, having broad coalition to negotiate and to talk to the Russians and the Iranians. I'm not saying this is possible, but it's certainly worth a try. But for that, you have to have a State Department that functions here. You need to have a National Security Council that wants to push for this. And at the moment, as you pointed out, you know, President Trump one day says one thing, another day does exactly the opposite, and we never really know exactly what it is that he's thinking. I mean, his tweet a few weeks, 2 weeks ago, that he wanted to pull out all the American troops out of Syria was terribly, terribly ill-advised. Why he did it, we still do not know to this day, right? And pulling out the American troops without having accomplished the job, which is to completely eradicate ISIS, and to also leave the allies that the United States fought with, the Syrian Kurds, alone to face a whole series of enemies after they sacrificed so many of their own to do our bidding. So it's terribly badly thought. And in fact, the Pentagon came back and pushed him on this. But apparently the White House is still maintaining this position that it wants to pull those troops out, because President Macron yesterday, in a very long interview with French television, said that he had convinced President Trump to stay the course in Syria. And we find out today that the White House pushed back and said, no, we still want to pull the troops out. So you have complete chaos at the moment at the White House. And this is not the way to run policy. It's okay to do strikes on the chemical facilities, but as I've argued, you know, this is a very limited political strike. It's not military. It was designed to send a message to Assad about chemical weapons and chemical weapons only. But you still need a broader strategy. I mean, this, to have a one-off action in the middle of chaos really doesn't make that much sense.
Well, the earlier remark of pulling out in a rally in Ohio that the president made, and then subsequent, as you just mentioned, to Macron's interview on French television, the pushback from the White House, could be categorized as strategic malpractice because, again, you give up a chip and you get nothing in return. What kind of position can the U.S. play in terms of an end game here? My sense is that there might be some daylight between the Russians and the Iranians. I believe the Russians are very frustrated with Assad because he won't negotiate, whereas Iranians are quite ruthless and may well have been behind about this latest gas attack. Obviously, there's no State Department, and we don't have a Secretary of State, and we have a hawk as a National Security Advisor, but what kind of strategy could the U.S. play if we had better leadership?
No, look, with the American troops in eastern Syria, I mean, in some ways, I understand why any administration would like to get them out, because it's only 2,000 people. You don't want them to stay there for a long time because they're exposed. You don't know much what may happen tomorrow, etc. Okay, but we have them there. They are an important component because they control about 20%, maybe 25% of Syrian territory with the Syrian Kurds and the Syrian Democratic Forces. And they are, as you said, a chip. That is to say, they're a chip in terms of the future disposition of Syria. if the United States is at the table more powerfully, so to say, with those troops than with and without the troops, because it has something to bargain, right? It has something to bargain with the Turks, with the Russians, with the Iranians. Now, you have to also look at it from the Russian perspective. I mean, the Russians are in this because they want to show that the United States cannot push everybody around like it used to. Two, it's for the Russians, Syria is important, has always been important, because it is their entry card into the Middle East, especially into the Mediterranean. I think the Russians just concluded a 49-year deal with the Syrian regime over the lease of one of the naval bases on the Mediterranean. That gives them a lot of an important role, I should say, in the Mediterranean. They're not about to give this up. Putin wants to play big on the international scene, and Syria, to some extent, has been the way or the card he has used to go back into, should say, international politics in a major way. So there may be daylight, or there may not be daylight between the Iranians and the Russians. But I don't know that for a fact. But what I can say is that the Russians are going to be very hard to negotiate with. But the what you need to convince the Russians, that in the long run, that they can still have a role in Syria, but backing Assad is going to be a very expensive proposition, because they're not going to be able to win decisively against the insurgency. This insurgency is going to last for some time to come. And at some point, the Russians may also pay with casualties.
Well, isn't there another wild card, Henri Barki, and that is Israel's concern about Iran's growing influence? You mentioned in your article at the National Limited Strikes, Limited Goals and No Strategy on Syria that the U.S. 2,000 troops there are preventing the completion of the materially unimportant but symbolically crucial Tehran-Baghdad-Damascus-Beirut highway or land bridge that would signify a regional victory for Iran. My understanding is that the Israelis don't want that to succeed, and they don't want these Arab Shia militias from Iraq that are being trained as Iranian proxies to come into Syria.
Well, that's true, but nobody wants that land bridge. I mean, when I say the land bridge is materially unimportant but psychologically important, I mean the Iranians don't need a land bridge to bring arms to Hezbollah. I mean, they've been doing it for years. There are many other ways you can fly, you can send ships. So the land bridge is the psychological factor that, especially for the Saudis and other Gulf countries, it would be seen as a major victory for the Iranians, and that the Iranians will be able to throw more of their weight around if they succeed, essentially, in having that land bridge. Again, psychologically, not materialism. So, yes, that's why I think the United States should keep the troops in eastern Syria for the time being, use them as a lever, and use that to get a better bargaining position at the table, but also get the Gulf countries with you and come up with a strategy. Look, Syria has been very complex with all these peace negotiations, whether it is Astana process or the Geneva process. Secretary of Defense Mattis clearly says he prefers the Geneva process, which is international, where the other one is Russians and Turks and Iranians. But you have to come up with some big comprehensive solution. So you have to work on it. But at the moment, I don't think the Americans and the Gulf countries are agreed on any specific policy or strategy.
Well,
we don't know. We don't know at the moment whether the White House has made its peace with Assad winning. Maybe it has. Maybe it hasn't. I mean, certainly Trump implies that he has made his peace, but the rest of the bureaucracy doesn't seem to have come to that conclusion. And there is a great deal of resistance to that idea in the American public. So we don't know where we are.
Well, but surely things could get worse. You've got something over 1 million Syrian refugees along the Jordanian border. You've got, I think, more in Turkey. You've got the possibility of another siege of Idlib province and refugees, Sunni Arabs, pouring into Turkey and perhaps even on into Europe again, which happened when the Russians first came in. So there's an awful lot more mischief or mayhem, I think is a better way to put it, that Assad could exercise. So what is the position of the Turks and the Jordanians in terms of what are you going to do with all those millions of people?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, look, the thing we seem to forget about all this is that Assad has no intention of taking back these refugees. There are 3 million refugees in Turkey alone. As you said, up to 1 million on the Jordanian side of the border. Many more in Iraq and in Kurdistan, right? Europe, and you can go on and on. Oh, this, not to mention Lebanon. I mean, Lebanese have no say in this matter, although they are the country that is most affected and most involved in this. They're involved because Hezbollah is doing the fighting for Assad. And the estimates are 1 in 4 Lebanese is actually Syrian, a refugee from Syria. And Assad doesn't want them back because most of these refugees are people that are unhappy with Assad and are potential dissenters. That's why take them back. Let other countries worry about it. That fact in of itself should be a very powerful incentive to come up with a solution, because otherwise all these refugees are going to be staying where they are. And or what will happen is what the Turks are doing now. The Turks invaded Syrian Kurdish territory, kicked out all the Syrian Kurdish population, and now are trying to push some of the Syrian refugees who are in Syria, in Turkey, into this area called Afrin, which is not, which is a Syrian Kurdish territory. But you're creating another problem that you're going to create that will, you know, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, will become another flashpoint for violence. So it is in the there are plenty of incentives as to why people should say enough is enough after 7 years of civil war, that we have to come up with a solution. But for that, you need some committed leadership. And I'm sorry, I don't see it coming from the United States, and I don't see it coming from anybody else at the moment, which is why we have all these different efforts, Geneva and Astana, and none of them will ultimately produce anything. Because, first of all, Assad feels no pressure at the moment, absolutely none, which is why, in some ways, he did what he did in terms of using chemical weapons. And there's no pressure on him. I mean, the truth is, he's been using chemical weapons, but he hasn't produced large number of casualties and therefore did not attract the world's attention. This time, there was something happened, and lots of people died, and suddenly the world woke up. But in reality, Assad is doing whatever he wants to do, and there are no constraints on him. So you have to change that calculation. You have to figure out a way to put in pressure on Assad, because the Iranians and the Russians are not going to do it. And so if they don't do it, who's going to do it? Why should he change his policies when he thinks he's doing very well, thank you?
And this is rather symbolic and rather cosmetic use of 105 cruise missiles on buildings that I think were largely empty certainly doesn't seem to have impressed him.
No, the one thing I would add is this particular raid was a political message. Right? Part of when you look at what Macron said that night, is he crossed the red line and we hit him. And the implication is, you do it again, we'll do it again. But since now we've hit the chemical weapons production facilities, right, we may go for something else. And that is essentially the threat on Assad at the moment. And that's the only threat we have.
Well, Ari Bakhy, I thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Ari Bakhy. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania and a senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller. And his latest article at The National is Limited Strikes, Limited Goals, and No Strategy on Syria. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.